Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. Debbie Hillman will be joining me. She is the founder of Food, Farms, and Democracy, an online website raising awareness about food, farms, and democracy. And we'll talk more about it and tell you more about it in just a little bit when she comes on. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in the news. And, oh, my God, there's so many. And some events going on in the area that you might want to participate in. And, of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So we are not lacking anything in what's going on in the news. It just seems like every day there's a major thing. You know, this week we dealt with, you know, the resignation of Scott Pruitt. And, you know, as much as we all celebrated that and we're very happy about it, they have now, you know, now in his place is a coal lobbyist, Andrew Wheeler, who, if you look at his record, he could even be worse. And so we really need to let our senators know how we feel. The Environmental Protection Agency is the governmental office that is really in charge of protecting our food, water, and air. And obviously they have not been doing a very good job under Scott Pruitt, and they'll continue to not do a good job under Andrew Wheeler. You know, he is much more concerned with corporate interests and profits than he really is about the environment. And so we really need to speak up and let that be known. America was, you know, scrutinized by many countries, and I was certainly so embarrassed this week when at the World Health Organization, it just came out in the news, but I think the conference actually was a couple of months ago, but that we are going against a resolution that suggests and recommends breastfeeding for newborn babies. And it's just unbelievable that we could actually go in and hold our heads up and say we do not support breastfeeding when it is widely known. And, of course, you know, they talk about decades of research, and we're in an administration that doesn't believe in research because that's science, and we don't believe in science, according to this administration. They'd rather go on instinct and intuition. So they are actually threatening countries. Ecuador, who was sponsoring this resolution, they were threatened with trade punishments and reneging on military aid to Ecuador if they supported this resolution. So, of course, Ecuador backed out, as well as many of the other Latin America countries. And those are the kids that need it. Their parents don't have enough money to buy formula. They buy formula and they water it down too much. And it's just, you know, it's just not good. There are so many advantages for breastfeeding, and it is so much better and widely known and accepted that it's so much better. And yet our country is not supporting it, and not just not supporting it, it's threatening and bullying the countries that want to support it. Just like we did with GMOs, you know, countries that didn't want to accept our GMOs. We threatened African nations with lack of aid and such if they refused to buy our GMO products. So it's just horrible, and it just continues on and on. You know, then we have the Supreme Court nomination. You know, after Justice Kennedy announced his resignation or his retirement, you know, right now, the president has nominated Brett Kavanaugh, who has a history of going against climate change regulations. He is not supportive of women's right to choose. He is completely in favor of corporate giants and favoring them. And so, again, he is really going to, if he gets nominated and passes, he will set the stage for decades to come of a right-wing Justice Supreme Court, and we need to let our senators know about that. So basically what I'm saying is we all need to really take ownership and get involved in what's going on in our country, or we will be responsible for where it's going. I mean, it's really easy to say I had nothing to do with it, but if you're not fighting against it, you're having something to do with it. We need to all really participate in this process to make things better. So, anyway, lots of great things going on in the city. I love summertime. The city and surrounding areas. First off, I've mentioned this before, there's an ongoing art exhibit up at Storm King Art Center focusing on climate change, and they're highlighting 17 contemporary artists, and they all are, all the sculptures, which is a beautiful acres and acres of open rolling hills up in Cornwall, New York, and beautiful sculptures, and they have, you know, their regular sculptures, plus they have these 17 extra sculptures there right now that are exploring climbing temperatures, rising sea levels, you know, everything that's related to climate change. And the Natural Resource Defense Council's artist in residence, Jenny Kendler, also will have a piece there. So check out Storm King Art Center. It's a wonderful thing to do on a beautiful day. Also, I want to let you know before the deadline approaches, which is coming up in just a couple of days, July 15th, if you want to join Al Gore's Climate Reality Leadership Training, that's taking place in L.A. from August 28th to the 30th, and you can sign up for it now. It is free of charge, but you do have to cover your own travel expenses and lodging. So if you really want to take your activism to the next level, check out this Climate Reality Leadership Training. Then, coming up this weekend, actually starting tonight, I'll be up at Stone Barns Center for Agriculture. They are having a summer evening event, which is actually three Thursday nights in a row starting tonight. And tonight, Anna Lappe will be speaking. She's from the Small Planet Institute. Her mom, Frances Moore Lappe, wrote the book Die for a Small Planet, which actually set me on my path of seeking out better food and connecting how our food choices impact our environment and our climate and people and animals and everything. So anyway, I'll be up at Stone Barns tonight. These summer evenings are only $20 each, and if you sign up for all three, I think it's a bargain. You get for $50, and they open up early so that you can have dinner in the Blue Hill Cafe, which is really lovely too, and enjoy a nice glass of wine while touring the farm. So that's tonight. Starting today, also, there's a Permajam Festival. I wish I had known about this ahead of time so I could have given you all more time to go there. I don't even know if there's still tickets left, but I was so excited to find out about this Permajam Festival. It's 4 days and nights, family-centered, musical performances, permaculture, workshops, yoga, dance, bonfires, jamming, hiking through the beautiful sanctuary in Orange County. It's at the Blossomdale Sanctuary in Bloomingburg, New York. And it just sounds like a wonderful, wonderful thing. There'll be sweat lodges, wellness workshops, and you can camp right there on site. So check out the Permajam Festival if you don't have plans for this weekend. The weather's supposed to be beautiful. Also this weekend, the Perfect Earth Project, which is Edwina Van Gaal's organization. She was a guest on my show last year. She's really teaching people how to take care of your lawns in a natural, more organic way. And so she's having an open garden day this weekend on July 14th, Saturday, from 1 to 3 in East Hampton. I know it's a schlep out there, but if you're out there anyway, you definitely want to check this out. You'll learn how to make compost teas, learn how to test your soil or send your soil out for tests, but then really to interpret the results, which is really important when you're testing your soil. But learning how to make compost tea and working that into your regular routine in your garden is really wonderful. So you can register online at gardenconservancy.com. So check that out. Also this weekend, Glenwood Food and Farm is having an open house from 12 to 4 on Saturday, and that's in the Hudson Valley in Cold Spring. And they're a wonderful center. They have lots of ongoing events throughout the year, but this event will include tours, tastings, hands-on demonstrations, and live music. You'll learn how to make your own ice cream. There'll be some harvesting of vegetables, fermenting workshops, beekeeping, lots of stuff going on. So that should be really fun if you have the time to go there. A whole bunch of my friends from Slow Food North Shore took off today to head to Denver for the Slow Food Nations. I went last year. I'm not going this year because I just have too much going on, but Slow Food Nations is wonderful. And if you're there, I consider yourself really lucky to be able to participate in Slow Food Nations. But if you don't know about Slow Food, it is an international movement. Slow Food USA is our national slow food organization, and there's over 200 chapters in our country. And Slow Food North Shore is the one on Long Island that I have been involved with for the past 8 or 10 years. And it's just wonderful. It's about good, clean, and fair food, and it really wraps everything about food that's good together, having to do with not just the quality of the food and how it's grown and who grows it and pesticide-free, hormone-free, GMO-free, all that good stuff. But it's also about celebrating food, celebrating the biodiversity in food, celebrating the pleasures around the table and enjoying with people you love the company of eating together and the joy that comes from that. And that's the piece that I think is missing in so many food center groups, is taking the pleasure away from it. And that is just fundamental. I mean, eating together, festivities, every life cycle event has food as a part of it, because food brings people together. And I've seen the power of that so many times in my life, and it's just wonderful. So check out Slow Food in your local area if you're not already a member. Join, and especially if you travel around, you know, you can look up slow food restaurants and know that you're going to a restaurant that that has been vetted, where the food and the quality and the ingredients are what you want to eat. So do check them out. This weekend, the Sylvia Center is having their farm-to-table dinner. That's up at Catskey Farm in Kinderhook, New York. And the Sylvia Center is a wonderful organization. They were guests on my show a couple weeks ago. And if you go out there, you'll be supporting these wonderful children's programs that they have year-round in the city and up in the Hudson Valley. So check that out. Also, Sunday, July 15th, the Kelly Street Garden Community Brunch is happening. And that's a collaboration between Just Food, which is a wonderful nonprofit in the city, and the Kelly Street Garden up in the Bronx. And it's a three-course community brunch fundraiser. And tickets are on a sliding scale, so you can go to either of those websites to find out more information about that. July 19th, we're still boycotting Wendy's. Wendy's is one of the is the only fast food holdout that I'm aware of, actually, that is still refusing to pay a penny extra per pound for their tomatoes and support the Immokalee workers, who are, you know, coming together under the coalition of Immokalee workers to demand better working conditions, do away with slave labor. And it's just amazing. I actually had Barry Estabrook on my show last week, talking about he's the author of Tomatolands, talking about the plight of the tomato farmers down in Florida. And it's actually quite amazing, since his first book, it's now in its third edition, and just in those few short years, the change that has taken place is just remarkable in awareness and in the changing of conditions of the worker rights. So it's nice to know that we actually can make a change when things go public and people start speaking out against it. So on July 19th, there's a boycott for Wendy's, so you can join the coalition of Immokalee workers and come out. And it starts at Treon Partners, 280 Park Avenue near 49th Street, at 5 p.m. on Thursday, July 19th. So then July 19th is also the second of the summer nights at Stone Barns. And then the third one is July 26th. And at July 19th, Anna Chai and Nari Kai will be will be there. They're the award-winning directors from the film Food Waste. Actually, on Food Waste. The film is called Wasted, the story of food waste. So come out and learn more about that on July 19th. And on July 26th, it's Marcia DeLonghi. And she's a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And like I said, if you go to all three of them, you save $10. So that's a nice thing. July 19th, there's a good beer tasting and food festival presented by Edible Manhattan. And that's down at Liberty Street. So you might want to check that out. That's always fun. And then Food Truck Rodeo is coming to Crossroads Farm on July 20th. Also worth going to. July 21st is a farm and compost tour at Queens Botanical Gardens. And the NOFA New York Summer Festival is coming up, or Summer Conference, August 10th through the 12th. So you want to save time for that. And also October 8th, save the date for the Food Tank Summit coming to New York City. All really amazing events, and there's a lot more. I'm not going over all of them, but you can find them all on my website at iegreen.com. So I do want to share with you my weekly recipe so that I can then invite my guests on. This week I made a vegan pesto spinach lasagna with a cashew ricotta. And I've done this dish similarly using tofu as the ricotta cheese, but I've been working more and more with the cashews, and this is just a really nice alternative to that. So I'm going to give you the ingredients first, and then we'll go into the directions. So making the cashew ricotta filling, you're going to soak 3 cups of cashews for at least 2 hours. You're going to also add 2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast, 1 teaspoon of salt, and 1/2 teaspoon of white pepper. Then for the sauce, I used 1 jar of organic marinara sauce. It's a 32-ounce jar. 2 tablespoons of minced garlic, 1 can of diced fire-roasted tomatoes, 1 onion, 1 yellow or orange organic pepper. And peppers are one of the on the dirty dozen list, so you really do want peppers to be organic along with tomatoes. White wine, 1/4 cup, a box of organic rice lasagna noodles, 1/2 cup of chopped parsley. And then for the spinach pesto filling, you can use 1 pound of frozen chopped spinach, 1 onion, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, and 3/4 cups of pesto. And then for the cheese, the top cheese, the mozzarella cheese, I use Miyoko's cashew mozzarella cheese. And it's the best, I think, cheese alternative out there on the market. And you really can grate it. You know, it comes in a block, and you can grate it with a grater just like any other cheese. And it really melts and is delicious. So check that out. So making the lasagna and bringing it all together, you first can make the pesto, or you can purchase a pesto. But since this is a vegan dish, most pesto that you buy has cheese in it. So this is a vegan pesto, and I used 4 cups of basil leaves. And the basil is really growing great in the garden, so this is a good time for this recipe. 4 cups of basil leaves, 8 cloves of garlic, 3/4 cups of toasted pine nuts, 1 cup of olive oil, 1 tablespoon nutritional yeast, 3/4 teaspoon salt, and 1/4 teaspoon of pepper. And you just pulse that in a food processor. And I already had this made. I make this regularly, and I keep it in my refrigerator. You're going to use 3/4 cup, but you're going to have like 3/4 cup left over. So this is really enough for making it twice, or just keep the extra in the refrigerator, you know, and put it over everything, you know, on your bagel, in sandwiches, over pasta, whatever you want. So then putting it all together, for the sauce, you're going to saute the onion, the garlic, and pepper in some olive oil in a stock pot. And when the vegetables are soft, you're going to add 1/4 cup of the wine and cook that down for about 5 minutes. Then add the marinara sauce, the can of diced tomatoes, and 1/4 cup of the chopped parsley. Meanwhile, you're going to drain the cashews and pulse those in a food processor with 3 cups of water, nutritional yeast, salt, and pepper, and pulse that until it's really smooth. And then taste it, and you can adjust the salt and pepper. And, you know, some people really don't like salt, and you can just leave the salt out, too, if you want to reduce your salt intake. and it still will be delicious. And then in a skillet, you're going to saute the onion with the garlic until translucent. You're going to defrost the spinach and squeeze all the excess water out and add the spinach to the saute pan with the onions and the garlic and just saute that for a few minutes and then add the 3/4 cup of pesto to the spinach. And like I said, you're going to save the remaining pesto for another time. So now you have the cashew ricotta cheese, you have the sauce, and you have the spinach pesto mixture. So the lasagna, to assemble it, I use the lasagna noodles right out of the box. And these are brown, these are rice noodles. DeBoles is the brand that I use, but you can use any lasagna noodle that you like. And you do not need to cook it ahead of time, and you do not need to buy the lasagna noodles that say no cooking necessary, because those lasagna noodles are just super thin, and I don't recommend them at all. So you want regular lasagna noodles, and what's going to happen is they actually cook in the sauce and in the cashew cheese, and so they become a little bit more al dente, and they hold together really well, because we also don't have any eggs in this lasagna. So you're going to first cover the bottom of the lasagna pan you're using with some tomato sauce. Then you're going to add a single layer of the dry lasagna noodles right out of the box. Spread half of the cashew ricotta cheese over the noodles. Add half of the spinach pesto over the cashew ricotta. And then sprinkle about 1/3 of the grated mozzarella, the vegan mozzarella cheese, over that. Then you're going to cover with a layer of sauce and then repeat it again. The noodles, the ricotta cheese, and then the spinach, or the cashew ricotta. Then you cover the whole thing with sauce, add one more layer of noodles, cover it with sauce again, and then put the remaining Miyoko's mozzarella cheese on top. Cover it with tin foil and bake for about 40 minutes. Then remove it from the oven, uncover it, and cook it for another 20 minutes. And you know it's finished when you can pierce it with a fork and the noodles are soft. And that's basically it. And then I garnish the top with some fresh chopped parsley. And it's delicious. I'm telling you, I served it to a group of people and nobody even knew it was vegan. Nobody knew it was gluten-free. It just tasted like delicious lasagna. And that's what you're going for. You don't want to be telling everybody, oh, this is vegan or this is, you know, different. The whole idea is to make it taste just as good as the best lasagna they've had so that they are really enjoying it. And that's it. So if you make the lasagna, please let me know. Shoot me an email. I'd love to get some feedback. And now it's my pleasure to invite Debbie Hillman on. As I said earlier, she's a professional gardener, a community activist, and founder of Food, Farms, and Democracy, which is an online site that documents the 21st century food and farm movement through the activities and perspective of an urban Midwesterner. And that's what Debbie is. She grew up in the Chicago area. She now lives in Evanston, and she was also the co-founder of the Evanston Food Policy Council, which was active from 2005 to 2014, and they worked to develop a comprehensive food and farm agenda for the Evanston, Illinois area. And now foodfarmsanddemocracy.net focuses on food and farm policy and projects, integrating policy and public policy components that involve money, democracy, and spirituality. And I'm going to let Debbie tell us more about that. Debbie, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful.
Can you hear me?
Thanks so much for joining me.
No, this is great. I love hearing all the events that are happening in New York, and I love your recipe, and I totally agree. You do not have to cook the lasagna noodles ahead of time. That's a lifesaver.
So how did you get involved in food advocacy? When, you know, how long have you been working in this agenda?
Well, I was born an activist, absolutely. The day I was born, I was born to be an activist, and I fell in love with the U.S. Constitution in seventh grade when we all usually study it. And I grew up during the '60s, so you know, I campaigned for Eugene McCarthy. I was, you know, somewhat involved in the protests against the Vietnam War. I went to college in Washington, D.C. because I thought I was going to get into policy, although it turned out it took me 40 years to get back to policy. That's a long story. Uh-huh. But I was always an activist, and I was really an activist because of language, because I saw the disconnect between what authorities said and what actually was being lived out in our American society on many, many levels. So language was always sort of my entry into just unpacking everything. And then after college, I traveled a bit, and I spent 7 months in India, which was totally eye-opening because it was a totally different culture. I would go down the street and I would see words like homeopathy all over the place, you know, and I knew what homeopathy was, but I didn't really know. And so what that told me was that there is an alternative model to health, to medicine. And so that led me to do a lot of reading. And when I got back home, the first book that, I mean, you talked about The Diet for the Small Planet, mm-hmm. you know, keying your path. The first book that I picked up specifically on food was by Dick Gregory, who was a comedian. But he came to understand how you can take control of your health by eating better. And so that's really started me on, you know, creating a way of managing your own life with something so real, like food. So I didn't come to food advocacy until later in my life, in my 50s, when I had already been a community activist on many issues and many things, but I had a family, and my daughter had grown up, and I was looking for something bigger to do, and there was already a large sustainability network in Evanston, in my hometown, that I was part of. I was working on alternative energy and pedestrian issues, and then somebody suggested that we have a couple of events on food. And so one person was putting together a great event at a local synagogue here, and Fred Kirschenman was the keynote of that event. This was back in 2005. But the rest of the panel was all about the bad stuff about our food system, which, you know, factory farms, GMOs, water pollution, and things like that. And that's all things that we need to know. But I thought, reading the agenda, I thought, oh my God, people are going to come out of there really depressed. And so 2 weeks later, I started planning another event that was going to take place 2 weeks later, and it was going to be, well, okay, what are people doing about those things or about our food system? And at that point, I didn't know what a food system was, and I was learning just like everybody else in the room. But we had a local organic chef. We had a representative from Slow Food. We had a community organizer who was organizing around the state around food. And we had a small grocer and, I don't know, one other person, somebody from the farmer's market, I guess. We have a great farmer's market here in Evanston. So we had both events were really great. They were really well attended. And I thought that was the end of it. A couple months later, people from the larger sustainability group came back to me and said, we think we should create a food group. We think that is something that people will get together around. And in 5 seconds, I said yes. And, you know, and so sort of here I am. So there were two of us who co-founded the Evanston Food Policy Council in 2005. And it was strictly
Did you have politicians working with you? Were there, you know, local representatives?
No, initially we did not know what we wanted to do. You know, we came up with a zillion ideas, and we didn't really know where the leverage points were. So, as I said, we were trying to educate ourselves first. So one of our members, we had a first meeting in August of 2005. I mean, I think there were 30, 40 people there. And one of the members said we should show films because that's a very good way to have discussions. And at that point, there were a few really good food films coming out. And that's what we did. We started just showing films and having discussions afterwards. A few months later, a group of people suggested creating an urban farm. And so it turns out there was a bit of a split there. It was a positive split, but it was a split because there were some people who really wanted to just do a project, a very hands-on project, like an urban farm. And I am more of a policy person, as were a few other people. And so the urban farm took off, and it still exists. It's called the Talking Farm. The farm was something to say, and it's part of the larger Chicago network of terrific urban farms, and I know New York has many such farms as well. But I wanted to work on policy, and so we started talking to our state legislator, who was a really good legislator, and we knew that she would listen, talk to us, give us honest feedback. And basically, the first thing she said in April of 2006 was, "Well, I hear there's some issues, but I'm not really sure what's happening. So keep talking to me, and show me that it's a large coalition," meaning she would only do something if it was for the benefit of all of Illinois, which was a real big gift, you know, because, you know, Evanston is just it's a suburb of Chicago, 75,000 people, and Illinois is 13 million people. So we had two more meetings with Julie Hamus in 2006, and the third meeting was in October of 2006, where we brought some farmers from Central Illinois, because I was very mindful of what she had said, show me it's a big coalition. And so here we are, October, harvest season, and here's two farmers sitting in a suburban legislator's office. They don't know her. They only trust the people who made the connection. And after an hour, she said, "Okay, I hear that there's some really serious issues here, but I'm also hearing that all of you, and I think there were like eight of us at the table, all of you are not in agreement as to what needs to be done." So the legislative solution, which is really, I mean, I know probably people roll their eyes at this kind of thing, but the right thing to do was that she created a two-year task force. And so there were 35 of us meeting every month, and we came up with a report. And in 2009, we published the report. The Illinois General Assembly adopted it and created a state food council. And so those 2 years of my life was where I did my most learning about, you know, what's a food system, what are rural people up against, you know, what are the farmers dealing with, and how do we make these connections?
Let me just get this straight. So the Evanston Food Policy Council became a state food policy council. Is that correct?
No. I mean, the Evanston Food Policy Council was just one player in that. And we continued to work after the state council was created, but it was a statewide coalition. So there were people from all over the state on the Illinois Local Food Farms and Jobs Council. First the task force and then the council. So, I mean, yes, I mean, and I can't take full credit for it, but I can certainly give my legislator the credit for being the chief sponsor of that bill. I mean, she wrote the legislation. That's what was so, I mean, she herself wrote it. So, But it was definitely a statewide coalition. So we were just, the Evanston Food Council was just one of the coalition members.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to your company or your organization that you just founded called Food Farms and Democracy. And when did you start that up?
I think about 5 years ago. I'm not really a company. I'm not incorporated. And the problem in the food and farm world, as many people know, is it's hard to get paid for anything in the food and farm world. I mean, it's hard to get paid as a farmer. It's hard to get paid as a labor activist. And it's really hard to get paid as a policy person. So I would like somebody to pay me, but I don't look at it as a company. I mean, at the age of 67, I may never have any more income, although I will certainly need some in about a year. So it's more of a sort of a personal forum where I can share, you know, my insights and I try and also, although I work on a national level, as you know, because you found me on ComFood, I really think of myself primarily as a Midwesterner, and so I try and just make my website as a place for people to find some high-level information on, you know, what kind of organizations exist in the Midwest and who has a food policy council, what states have a food plan. So my website is just mostly sharing information, mm-hmm. and I blog.
But let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I actually want to kind of dissect them a little bit and get into the food part, the farm part, and the democracy part, and how you brought them all together, okay? So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Debbie Hillman, and we're just going to take a couple-minute break, and we'll be right back.
Hello, this is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse.
And Dr. Z, Eugene Zamperone, licensed naturopathic physician. We're both authors, medical school professors, and natural health practitioners with decades of experience.
Join us to discover the latest true and tested information about natural medicine, how to take care of yourself and your family naturally, and avoid the downward health spiral linked to the overuse of pharmaceutical drugs.
Explore ancient, indigenous herbal healing, natural foods, homeopathy, and the mind-body interlude. Learn the real deal. Natural medicine is supported by scientific inquiry.
Lots of ways to listen. For instance, live or archived. You can listen to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, or anytime by visiting PRN.FM, click Archives, and scroll to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Or you can call in on our private listener line at 701-719-0884, or go to your favorite app store and download the Progressive Radio Network app. Listen live or to the archives anytime. Until next time, we both hope you stay healthy.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial, free, and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media, so Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and Ayi Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Debbie Hillman, founder of Food Farms and Democracy, an online forum where you can find out about food, farms, and democracy. Debbie, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So, anyway, let's go through the different items in your tagline and see and talk about them. Why food, why farms, and why democracy?
So food is the obvious piece, and I think I explained a little bit how I came to that, and I think most of us are coming to food because it's the survival thing that we need every day.
Mm-hmm.
And the food farm, the food and farm movement, I think, has developed because American voters just realized that we hadn't been talking about the food system for all of my lifetime. I'm 67, and that's created a whole bunch of problems in terms of health, environment, et cetera. So food, and you also talk about pleasure. It's something that does really bring people together, and we all need it. You can't get out of it. It's not a party affiliation. We're all in the food party. So that's where we started, and I quickly realized, working in Illinois, which is a farm state, 85% of our land is working farmland, I realized that if we only talk about food and we don't talk about the land and the people who own the land or manage the land or farm the land, we're leaving a really important piece out. So food and farm became just sort of, I was trying to reprogram my own brain to just say, this is what we're talking about, food and farm, urban, rural, food and farm. And so for a couple of years, that's just how, I would write press releases or emails or whatever, and I'd try and use that language. But sitting in Springfield, Illinois for 2 years of monthly meetings also showed me how ignorant Americans are on what democracy is, on just how to sit down and have a conversation where we don't all agree at the beginning, but maybe we can come to an agreement by the end or by the sixth meeting or by 2 years later or something. People didn't know how to do that. The chairperson of our task force, who was a dean at a university, didn't know how to draft an agenda, how to follow the agenda, or maybe he wasn't interested in following the agenda. I don't know. But there were a lot of backroom deals going on during our public task force. So that told me there's something deeper here than just problems with the food system. There's really deep problems just as being an adult and not knowing how to work things out.
Right, right. And so, we see that playing out in our own government every day. Now, I want to ask you, you say 85% of the land in Illinois is farmland. That's huge.
Right.
You know, I'm in New York, so I don't have that same ratio here. But how many of those people farming the land are concerned about doing it in a sustainable way? You know, whether certified organic or not, I don't really care so much about certification, but I'm talking about really being good stewards of the earth. Like, do the farmers that the majority of the farmers that you see in your state, has the awareness of taking care of the earth changed? Have they been, you know, trying to, even if they're not fully certified, are they trying to improve their practices? What do you
think? I mean, yeah, you know, I think Illinois is the same as most other states in the U.S. It's a mixed bag. There are definitely people who have been asking questions from the very beginning. There was a family farmer on our task force who went organic cold turkey, and I think he had something like 1,500 acres. So in 1 year, yeah, I mean, you don't get certified in 1 year, but in 1 year, he decided to not use, you know, pesticides or herbicides, or I don't know the specifics of his farm, but he really saw it. And yes, I mean, there's a huge movement.
And that way, my next question then with that farmer, and I don't know if you know the answer, how did it go? Did you know, as a role model for the other farmers, did he then take off because there's more demand for organic and he's doing great, or is he, you know, was that a financial bad decision for him and then the other farmers are afraid to do it?
Well, I don't think it was a financially bad decision. It was a number of years ago, and he's proven that it worked for him. But there are different ways to make it work in our food system because the larger distribution system is not set up for organic. But there are niche markets, and, you know, especially if you're near metropolitan areas, you know, then you can usually be successful if you transition to organic. But I think it's a mixed bag. And I also think, and I'm an urban person, so I'm probably not the right person to answer this question, but I would just point to, I think there's something in rural culture, rural American culture maybe, that prevents some people from learning quickly. I think that it might be the isolation. Until recently we didn't have the internet, and one of a huge pieces of connecting urban-rural people is to make sure that rural people have access to the internet at good speeds. I mean, that's a food and farm issue right there, is making sure everybody in America, especially rural America, is wired. So I probably can't answer that question for the rural farmers. I just know that it's way more complicated than all of a sudden, you know, waking up one day and deciding you're going to go organic. It's a huge decision to make. But I will say, and maybe this is sort of a place to sort of break this news, although I did mention it on Comp Food, the Organic Consumers Association has initiated a Midwest project where 12 or 13, so we haven't decided whether it's 12 or 13 states, are creating something. It's called Regeneration Midwest. And it's absolutely, you know, it may not be about organic certification, but it's absolutely about regenerating our soils, regenerating ourselves. It's about regeneration. And so they just had a planning meeting about 2 weeks ago in Minnesota, but this network is happening. It's called Regeneration Midwest, and I think the Organic Consumers Association is going to help other regions of the United States and the world create similar regional networks. And of course, there already are such regional, like the Chesapeake Food Shed. I think that's Food Shed Network. That's a big regional network, and I think they're trying to do the same thing. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. And so a few weeks ago, you also announced that you wanted to work with public banks in order to advance food and farm movement. And I know you're not, you know, a specialist in public banking, but can you just share a little bit, what does that mean? You know, how would public banking advance the food and farm movement, in your opinion?
Right. So one of the when I saw that democracy and our government processes and all of that were a part of the problem in our food system, I also saw that the money piece, the piece that the government is supposed to manage and control, is also a big issue, and in many ways. So So I've been sort of studying monetary reform and public banks for about 3 or 4 years, following the initiatives that are happening around the country. And I finally decided for myself that although we actually need to address U.S. money from a congressional standpoint and the Federal Reserve, because people, it isn't what we think it is. The Federal Reserve is not the U.S. government, unfortunately, although it is regulated by the U.S., but it's owned by commercial banks. So our U.S. money is corrupt from a very deep level. But I don't think personally in 2018 that we're going to accomplish much at the federal level. And so I was looking to try and figure out, well, how do we address this money question? How do we get more money into food and farm projects, into just, you know, everyday people who need more money? And public banks, it's like each state has its own currency. It's still dollars, and it's not a different currency, but public banks the money that's deposited in public banks is the taxpayer money, the income that states get. And then a public bank, in their charter, it should say something about only lending out that money according to that state's policies. So, for example, the Bank of North Dakota is the only public bank in the United States. It's exactly 100 years old, I believe. And so they have been supporting their farmers in really positive ways. Now, they've also allowed fracking, and that's a different story, but that is their state policy.
Public banking organizes everybody's thinking in terms of this is what public money is going to be used for, this is where it's going to be held, and the banker, the state bank, which acts as a central bank, it does not compete with community banks. It sort of acts as the state's own Federal Reserve, and then it funnels money through the community. The loans go through the community banks. So another example is the state of Minnesota has a bill in the pipeline right now to create a state bank of Minnesota, and the first item in the list of things that they want to accomplish is to lend money to beginning farmers. And this would be low-interest loans, I believe. I mean, I don't know the specifics. So this is using Minnesota taxpayer money to lend to beginning farmers in Minnesota. And this is still a proposal. It has not been passed, but it's the kind of thing that I'm supporting. So I don't know if I'm making this a little bit clear.
I think it's pretty, self-evident, the fact that there's only one public bank in all of America right now, that the control that banks have over money is not one that they're willing to give up very easily. And so it's hard to get public banking going, it sounds like. But I certainly hope that can happen.
There are proposals all over the United States. The city of Los Angeles, either they just voted or they're going to vote on a public bank. The state of California has a proposal. Santa Fe, Vermont. I mean, Public Banking Institute is the major organization that's proposing public banks. So people go on their website, they will, can sign up for a newsletter. And it's really getting more educated on what money is, what the money system is, what the banking system, and there's a lot of people working on it. But I think public banks is a way to help people
as quickly as possible once once the banks are created.
Yeah, and do you know if in the new farm bill that just got passed whether there is provisions for I know there was a provision in there, but I don't know if it got passed with it for beginning farmers, to support beginning farmers.
I don't know. I can't imagine that it wouldn't have been approved, part of the approval, but I mean, it's such an important thing, but who knows?
Everyone listening, I'm going to find out, because I know so many different parts of the farm bill were cut, and it was back and forth between the House and the Senate and back and forth, and I know the Senate version that got passed was much better, and I'm actually not sure. I think they might still need to be negotiating before they finally pass the final farm bill. But I will find out, everybody, and let you all know. Well, we are just almost out of time. Is there anything you want to share? I know we didn't get at all into your love of the Iroquois Constitution and studying that with the U.S. Constitution. Anything quick you want to say about the Iroquois Constitution that
I just think we need to learn more about it, because it had a lot of interesting clauses that Americans have never even thought about. For example, they had a sunset clause. Every 5 years, the whole thing had to be reapproved, and it could have been approved. I don't know exactly how it played out, but this Iroquois Constitution was created in 1142, so it's been around for a very long time. And I believe that the Iroquois, or I think they call themselves the Haudenosaunee, is the more modern term. And there's a lot of entities in New York State that are, that identify as Haudenosaunee and are working on this. I believe they think their constitution still exists and that their government still exists.
Mm-hmm. I can say is that, for the First Nations, I believe all of them agree that any decisions we make have to be good for 7 generations out, not just for now. But I hear my music coming on, which means we are out of time. Everyone, I'm sorry to end like this, but Debbie, thank you so much for joining me. And
thank you very much.
Listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and Debbie Hillman from Food, Farms, and Democracy has been my guest. Debbie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everybody out there, thanks for joining me, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now. I'm a